sit at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Free.
Jump.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Right. Will. Peace.
Losers.
Men.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall. And I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression. Expression.
Participation.
Democracy. Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solid.
Fill in the border. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good day to our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a global collection of musicians. I'm Jim Hutchings. I'm again here with my co-host Mona Hill, and we have a special guest, Dr. Carrie Bourassa. She's an associate professor of Indigenous Health Studies in the Department of Interdisciplinary Programs at First Nations University of Canada. She is also a nominated principal investigator of Indigenous Peoples Health Research Center. And we're pleased to welcome Dr. Bourassa to the show for a conversation about health concerns specific to Indigenous peoples. They include First Nations and Métis health as a priority. We'll discuss specific barriers to good health and also identify solutions to those barriers. Dr. Bourassa will also respond to the latest federal cuts in the 2012 budget that affects Aboriginal and Métis health. Welcome, Dr. Bourassa.
Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome, Carrie. It's wonderful to have you. And welcome to our listeners. This is going to be a very interesting show. And I wanted to start out by just reciting part of a presentation that Carrie sent me, because I think it's a great way to introduce her and what we're going to be talking about. She says, I immediately thought about my grandfather, and this is after reflecting on personal experiences about Native First Nation and Métis health issues. And her grandfather suffered multiple chronic diseases, and his experiences in the healthcare system perhaps were not the best. She thought that about her adopted Mushum, who had two chronic diseases and also had less than ideal experience. But I also thought, and this is so important, about their resilience. I believe that Aboriginal communities are the most resilient in the world. While we have many obstacles to overcome, we also have much to celebrate and many gifts to share with the world. So we're going to begin. We're going to start this show today on your final words of that paragraph, which I'd like to begin by identifying some barriers. So when we're talking about First Nation, we're talking about Inuit, Métis healthcare, why is it different than the mainstream society healthcare? What's going on? What are those barriers?
I think what most Canadians tend to overlook is that for many First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people, poverty isn't just poverty. we have a history of colonization in Canada, and that doesn't just end. It doesn't just stop. It has unfortunately continued, and we continue to feel those effects. We have intergenerational poverty. We have intergenerational trauma. And I know that a lot of people have suffered poverty and a lot of people have suffered trauma. But First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people are the only people that have experienced colonization. They are the only people that have attended residential schools and had their identities stripped from them. And I don't think that this can be overlooked. In fact, it has to be acknowledged. And, you know, in talking with many people, and you start to explain and try to help them understand, you know, they can empathize and get it and understand, because that's why we see these huge gaps, and we have to start getting our heads out of the sand and addressing this, because the health gaps are not closing. They haven't closed. And you can look at any data, and I'll share some data later on in the show, but any of the data sets that we look at, we're not getting any closer to equity at all. And this should be alarming for Canadians. It should be alarming for everyone. So, as I said at the last, I was just speaking on Tuesday night at the NDP budget hearing. And I said, you know, if you don't want the social justice case, that's fine, but we're all taxpayers. And the Aboriginal population in Canada is the youngest, fastest growing demographic. And if you want us to be contributing to the economy, then we need to be healthy. And so this is an issue for everybody to take notice, and we right. all have to work together. So, you know, so this is really important for us to understand. So colonization is something that you know, is a huge issue. And so when we're looking at some of the barriers, understanding those, the underlying issue of the effects of colonization is important. But poverty right now is one of the key issues. One in four First Nations children live in poverty in Canada. And if you, I was talking to Chief Perry Bellegarde. He is very active with United Nations right now, and goes to several meetings. He just came back from a meeting in Geneva. And in fact, I asked if I could quote him. I was going to a meeting it was an Aboriginal Health Roundtable with the Governor General, and it was put on by the Canadian Nurses Association and the National Expert Committee. And they're looking at how to improve Aboriginal health. And I said, can I quote you? Because he said to me, he goes, you know, Carrie, goes, what you have to talk about at that panel is how poverty is affecting Aboriginal Canadians. And he said, remember that when you look at the United Nations Human Index, Canada ranks sixth in the world. And when you incorporate First Nations statistics, and that's because that's really the only data we have, we don't have accurate data for Métis people, for example, our numbers dropped to 63rd.
And that's on the United Nations Human Development Index.
That's correct.
So we're talking about human development.
Human development.
So to extrapolate that back to what you talked about earlier regarding poverty and children, how do you develop? How do you develop mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, if you don't have enough food to eat?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
For one example.
So poverty, you know, in his mind and in you know, in my mind, in many people's minds, poverty is the key issue that often gets overlooked and is a daily struggle.
And mainstream Canada might ask, why is there so much poverty? Why would you suggest that First Nation people, that Métis and Inuit people, have worse problems with poverty than other people?
Again, you know, this links directly back to colonization. I mean, this is the most marginalized, oppressed population, and that had a glass ceiling put on them, right? And yes. So particularly, I mean, you know, if I use First Nations people as an example, and First Nations people were forced into residential schools, and for generations were into these schools and got a grade 8 education, If you wanted to go beyond grade 8, you would lose your status.
Okay, so then you lose identity.
So and then you lose identity. Well, you were losing identity in the schools anyway.
True. This is true.
but even grade 8 education, coming out of grade 8 education in 1960s and 1970s, where is that going to get you?
Right.
So we have a lot of catch up to do, and not only that, we're only just starting to heal from residential schools. Yeah. I mean, we're in the era of truth and reconciliation, and how much reconciliation is occurring right now in Canada today. So we have, intense poverty occurring because this development was not allowed to occur for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people. I mean, for Métis people, just in the province of Saskatchewan, unless you were landowners, Métis children weren't allowed to go to school. In fact, they were grateful to go to residential schools, and residential schools would take Métis children if they didn't have enough First Nations children. So Métis children were living on road allowances in the ditches.
And I've heard that.
And it was Tommy Douglas in 1947, the Tommy Douglas government, that actually finally said, we can't have this anymore. These children must go to school, and allowed Métis children into the schools, and in fact built some Métis schools. Mm-hmm. So, you think about that, 1947, that's not very long ago. Mm-hmm. So, education is one key aspect that has been a factor. And our own education systems have not been valued as well.
True.
Our own traditional education systems have not been valued and in some cases still are not valued. Although certainly First Nations University of Canada is definitely filling a void in that respect, and balancing, meeting the Western standard, but also incorporating our traditional values and language systems as well.
Right. You also talk about people being tired of being diagnosed with chronic diseases and being labeled as being non-compliant in the healthcare system, and having just recently in the past winter come through an episode myself of being hospitalized, and where I got to a point where I felt that they felt I was being non-compliant. I kind of got a bit of an understanding of what that entails. Can you speak to that as being a barrier to healthcare?
And again, it is linked in many cases to poverty, but to some other issues as well, around cultural safety and people feeling safe in the healthcare system. And this did come out of the patient first review that we had just a few years ago. But for many First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people, they're often labeled non-compliant, and many of my own nursing friends and colleagues will speak to this. And I actually had a few years ago, I had an interesting conversation with a medical doctor. We were at an event for an entirely different purpose, and we ended up on this conversation around non-compliance. And she said, it's so frustrating because I have First Nations patients, and I know what they need to do, and I tell them, and they don't listen to me. And she was very upset, and mm-hmm. I could tell, she genuinely wanted to help her patients, but she had this strong frustration, and she couldn't understand why they were not following their regimen, right? They weren't taking their prescriptions, and they weren't following their diet. And she said, and diabetes is killing First Nations people, and on and on. And so I started to have a conversation with her, and I said, well, did you ever take into consideration that, For in some cases, I mean, sure, some prescriptions are covered, but often many prescriptions are not covered.
That's
for
right.
First Nations, which people always think that everything is covered. It's not. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes non-compliance is the fact that they cannot afford their prescriptions. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they cannot afford to eat healthy. They know what they need to do, right? They know that they need to eat healthy, but, they can't afford it. I mean, it's really expensive, as we all know, to buy the lean cuts of
meat.
It's
getting crazy. For those of middle income, it's crazy the amount of money we spend on groceries. I can't imagine living in poverty.
And that's in the city. I mean, let's talk about up north where milk is, you know, $10.
A bag of potatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And fresh fruit, I mean, you know, don't even think about it yet. Yeah, pop and chips is readily available and cheap, right? Because it's easy to, it doesn't spoil in the when it's being transported there. So, I mean, that's often they get labeled non-compliant. Often they won't say anything. There's sometimes some fear, you know, and sometimes simply that, you know, they're not going to defend themselves. And it's true in the Métis community, too. I've actually driven many elders to their appointments. Sometimes they can't get to appointments on time. Sometimes they're late. Transportation is an issue. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's such fear of racism, mm-hmm. Whether it's perceived or real, you know, to them. Perception is reality, that they won't say anything. They won't defend themselves. And I watched my grandfather go through that, where there, he experienced such racism that often he just would want to get out of there so he wouldn't say anything, you know.
I experienced that as well firsthand when I was doing advocacy work with First Nations men, and ending up in the emergency ward of the hospitals and having them say, I'm not staying. And the same response that you got from the nurses was, you have to stay because you're really, really sick. Really, I'll stay with you, but you got to stay. No, I'm not staying. And there was a point when I said to one young man, why don't you want to stay? What's really going on here? And he said, every single one of my family members has died in the hospital. I'm not staying. What can I say to that?
Yeah.
How do I address that?
Yeah.
You know, that's just one example of many.
Yeah.
And yes, I truly do believe, and I would swear on both my parents' graves, that there is definitely systemic racism in the healthcare system. I've seen it firsthand, and I've been shocked by it.
Yeah. Well, there is, but we don't like to say the R word.
Well, nobody, have any problem saying it.
Yeah. I think in general, you know, Canadians don't like to think that we're racist. You know, we're the nice people, and we don't have racism in Canada, and it doesn't exist here. But I'm sorry to say it does. Our institutions in Canada, all of them, are built on a colonial model that is inherently racist and sexist, and is built for an elite few. And so those of us that don't fit in that are othered. Mm-hmm. And that's for many people, not only Aboriginal people.
Those people.
Right? So many people are othered. And so, you know, having culturally safe care isn't only about Aboriginal people. It's about many people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Patient First Review actually revealed that and spoke in depth about the need for culturally safe care and the need to open lines. Most of it is just opening the line of communication. You know, it's really about talking and making, you know, making that person, that patient, feel comfortable and safe, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, you talk about communication, even to go so far as to understand that parts of the body, scientific names and words that are not available in other languages is huge when it comes to healthcare. Yeah. I did a stint for a while in the healthcare system, and I discovered that when there was need for interpreters, a lot of times the maintenance people, because those are the immigrants and the refugees, were coming to do interpretation for the doctors and the nurses with patients.
Yeah.
And they didn't have the right words to use. So where is a barrier? I mean, that's a huge barrier.
Absolutely.
To not be able to explain a part of the body that's interior that's not common to that language.
Absolutely. Well, we're starting to have some discussion. I know some First Nations communities are starting to have discussions around the need for patient navigators. To help navigate the system, and when there's a need for translators, especially in the north.
Oh, yeah.
Patients coming from the north into Royal University Hospital, for example, in Saskatoon. Mm-hmm. That's where there's, usually huge language barriers. So,
I think that the average Canadian, maybe the average global person, believes that everybody speaks English in Canada. Just because there's people up north doesn't mean they don't speak English. This is the 21st century, but that's not necessarily true.
No, and certainly not their first language. And so they may speak some English, but that may not translate, as you say, in a hospital setting, in a healthcare setting.
Right.
And to make them feel safe, they may indeed need a translator, or, you know, somebody from their community to come. And often that's not paid for. So can you imagine having to leave your community on your own and not have a good comprehension of the language or not be able to understand some of the medical, you know, language. And when a doctor comes in and is very busy, how much time do you actually get with that doctor and to try and understand what that doctor's saying to you when it's not your first language?
Right.
How intimidating that may be. And,
right. I mean, it's bad enough when it is your first language and you're using scientific terms and medical terminology that you've never heard before. So as another language, I can't imagine it being so much worse.
And understanding the compounding factors when you're thinking about all of these things together, you know, the poverty and access and transportation, mm-hmm. all these mm-hmm. things together. I mean, even just in Regina, Aboriginal people make up 9% of our population and 24% of the poor. So you think of the, you know, all the compounding things, and you think about where, you know, so if you're told you have diabetes, many Aboriginal people, if they have one chronic disease, they actually have, like, they have two.
Yes.
You know, about 60. Comorbid. Yeah, they have comorbidities. About 60% of Aboriginal people have two chronic diseases compared to about 40% of Canadians. So, mm-hmm. so there's comorbidities that are occurring, and so now you want to get access to. So even if you're in the city and you have food banks, think about where our food bank in Regina is located.
It's ridiculous.
Right. And now if you're a single mother and you have, I don't know, four or five children, and you have to, in the dead of winter, get on that bus to go get your groceries and take your kids with you in a stroller and now bring your groceries back home. I mean, and sometimes sometimes, you know, the other thing is a lot of times you don't know what to do with some of the food that you have, like some of the vegetables that are in those. So a lot of, we had a program for a while running out of our Métis local where we were helping people to learn how to cook with the food that they get from the food bank because
totally foreign.
You didn't really know what to do with some of it, right? And you know, then you could also have that community of people to learn how to do it together. But programs come and go, programs get cut, and that's actually frustrating in communities too, where you might have a 3-month program and it goes really well and people are you know, benefiting from it. And again, then the program is cut and it's gone out of the community, and there's that real sense of frustration in the community. And it's hard to keep momentum going in the urban centers. And then in the rural centers, there's no such thing as food banks. So
right.
Access to food is on reserve, and in remote locations is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. And transportation is another issue, especially if you're a senior.
Oh, yes.
And then, you know, in terms of exercise, right? So have you been onto a reserve lately? Is there lots of walking paths on reserve? What do you do in the wintertime, right? So all of these things compounded, you know, it creates a bleak picture for many Aboriginal Canadians.
It sounds like it does. What are some of the solutions that you've come up with through your work?
The solutions are community-based.
Okay.
You know, First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people, they know. First of all, they really do know what's wrong with them, but they also know what the solutions are, but they're often not asked.
Okay. Right?
They're often not asked. So the work that I do is always community-based, and I work with the communities to find those solutions. And they're engaged, and they drive the research that's going to find those solutions, the action-based work. You know, they're the ones that tell me what to do, and then we do it together.
And are you talking about rural communities, or are you talking about city communities?
Both. Yeah, okay. I've worked with a number of First Nations communities, a number of Métis communities in the city, and it's always the solutions always lie within the communities.
In your presentation, you call it, I believe, creating culturally safe care.
Yes.
Yes. How does that work?
We've created some culturally safe care. We started working, developing cross-cultural videos around end-of-life care in particular with a group of, with healthcare providers and with guiding elders. And the videos have been quite successful, and we've had, it's just a beginning, but we've had great success with just helping people to understand some of these barriers and mm-hmm. and helping people to understand what you know, First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people need in that time when they're in the hospital from healthcare providers.
It's more of a holistic perspective, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Right. And you mentioned also the inclusion of traditional medicine in that care.
Yes, and understanding what
and
that
how
means.
How well is that going? Good point. What does it really mean?
What does it really mean? I mean, doctor, physicians, they have to understand what that means in the care and what that means for them. Mm-hmm. But it's all about really opening the dialogue. you know, and dispelling some of the myths around it. Okay. And that's the first step.
Are you getting a fairly decent positive response to that, or how's that going?
You know, it's slowly but surely. It's funny, what my cookum actually, who is on the End of Life Care Project, she has kidney stones all the time. She's got diabetes, and mm-hmm. she manages it often with traditional medicine. And every, mm-hmm. once in a while, she, of course, has to pass a stone, and she goes right. to her doctor. Her doctor saw the video that she helped produce. And up until then, they had sort of been butting heads, and he didn't understand what this traditional medicine was. And she walked into his office one day, and he said, "I saw you today." And she said, "I don't know what you mean." And he said, "Well," he goes, "I saw it. Well, you don't know I saw you, but I saw you, and you have changed the way I see things."
Wow. That is so powerful.
And she said the relationship between them has been incredible since then. So I think it's yeah. a slow process of helping to people to understand different ways of doing things. And those are the gifts that I'm talking about that our communities have that we can share with others.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How much time we have to the break, Jim?
About a minute and a half.
A minute and a half. Okay. Mm-hmm. After the break, we're going to move on to a sort of a related but a little bit different topic about funding. What would you like to say then, in the, you know, until the break, about the systemic barriers and the other types of barriers that there are, and finding solutions?
I guess the other thing I wanted to just mention is we did a huge community-based project with the Métis community that started here in Regina, and it's really blossomed across the province. It was a community-based health survey, the first of its kind in Canada, and we actually trained community members to gather the data across Saskatchewan. But out of that, they identified what they wanted to work on, and we worked on assets instead of 52% of the people were smoking, which isn't good, right?
Right.
That's bad.
Right.
But the good thing is most of them weren't smoking in the home. So we celebrated that, and we handed out green lights to everybody that right. wasn't smoking. And then we said, you know, "Do you want to quit?" And then 72% of the people said yes. So mm-hmm. then we went out and we got funding, Dr. Viv Ramsden and myself, along with the Métis Nation, and we are now rolling out a peer-to-peer smoking cessation
Wonderful.
Project. Right?
Wonderful.
So, yeah. And it's so successful.
So you're just playing on strengths.
We're playing the strengths. They don't yeah. want to be told what's wrong with them.
Okay, I think we have to take a break.
Okay.
Thanks. We'll be back.
Okay, that was 10-year-old Takaya Blaney, and she's Sliaman First Nation from BC. Along with singing, songwriting, and acting, she's concerned about the environment, especially the preservation of marine and coastal wildlife. Shallow Waters, that's the title, was a semi-finalist in the 2010 David Suzuki Songwriting Contest Playlist for the Planet. The song was recorded in studio by audio producer Joe Cruz. Footage from Vancouver, BC was filmed by Coulter Ripley. Footage of the traditional ocean-going canoe from the Squamish Nation, Burrard Inlet, North Vancouver, BC. Tequila in traditional cedar bark regalia of Tofino, BC. The oil refinery... Just a second, I got to turn your mic on here.
Oh, I'm not on?
No, you are now.
Okay, so we can see this on YouTube. Where do people go to see it?
It's a great video. I just went to First Nations Music, and then I saw it about five selections down, Shallow Waters is the title.
It's lovely.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So we're back on Human Rights Radio, and I'm Mona Hill, and I'm here with my co-host Jim Hutchings, and today our guest is Dr. Carrie Barasa, who's a healthcare specialist. And we have been talking in the first half, if you haven't been with us, about many of the barriers to decent healthcare for First Nation and Inuit and Métis people, and talking about some solutions. And now we want to cover, Carrie, you went to the NDP meeting last week, was it?
Tuesday.
The funding cuts in the 2012 federal budget.
Right.
So we're going to spend the rest of our time on the show talking about these cuts and what they mean to First Nation and Métis people. Where would you like to start with that?
I guess I'll just start with the major cuts that came to the major... Aboriginal agencies, and I'll just sort of, and then I want to talk about what we know so far about the program cuts, and how it doesn't make sense considering what we know from the evidence. So far, Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada has had $165 million cut, and for some First Nations communities, you know, the bureaucracy in Aboriginal and Northern Affairs, many has feel as it has been, you know, bloated, and that money should go to First Nations and the regions, but we haven't seen that being redirected. So I guess there's questions there about where is that money going.
We're always hearing people complaining about how much money First Nations are getting from the government.
They're not getting enough to even sustain themselves, and all you have to do is look at Attawapiskat to see the reality of that. You know,
right.
What, you know, look at the poverty that people are living in on those reserves, and they're not even getting the money to sustain. And a large majority does go to this large administration that we have, and so. I think when some of the initial cuts came, although there's certainly sympathy for those workers who work hard, you know, the bureaucrats that work hard, the policy folks, and you do need a policy infrastructure. I'm not saying that at all. But there, I think, has been this sense that there's this really large, top-heavy infrastructure that could be handled by First Nations people themselves. But we're not seeing that transfer. So there's big questions there around where is this money going? and those questions have not been answered. The Native Women's Association of Canada, their entire health department has been gutted. And that has actually affected a project I have with them. I have an Aboriginal Women's Neurological Health Project that's funded by Public Health Agency of Canada. And, you know, although the project is still in place, it was supported by that infrastructure. So it has really affected our project, and it's affected several other projects. And they were the only national organization that was directly doing work with Aboriginal women's health.
So they lost all the funding for that?
They lost all their funding, yeah.
Wow.
The Assembly of First Nations, 40% of their health funding has been cut. The Inuit Taparik Kanatami, 40% of their health funding has been cut. The Paktuit Inuit Women of Canada had their health funding cut. The First Nations Statistical Institute has had 23 jobs cut. The Métis National Council had 100% of their health funding cut. And the National Aboriginal Health Organization is entirely eliminated, and they are winding down as of June 30th. So it seems as though there's an, you know, a sort of this attack on First Nation, Métis, and Inuit institutions, and you know, policy and research, right? The infrastructure for health. And then we look at the programs that have been affected by these cuts. So the Aboriginal Diabetes Initiative has been cut. And when you look at diabetes rates, they are anywhere from 3 to 5 times higher among Aboriginal people in Canada. And again, as I said before, diabetes often has comorbidities. So
right.
It's a...
And you can relate that back to the first half of the show when we talked about poverty issues. And,
absolutely. Yeah. Highly connected to poverty.
Yeah. It's almost like a setup for failure from the beginning.
Absolutely. In my opinion, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever to cut that program. It's a highly successful initiative. And the Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Program has been cut. Now, we don't have very good data on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. I mean, it's very difficult for people to, you know, mothers to say, yes, of course, I was drinking when I was pregnant. But we do know that 73% of First Nations people have reported alcohol problems. So we know that alcohol abuse is an issue in communities. Bloodborne, and that's, you know, those numbers are really difficult. Because
there's many similar symptoms to other diagnoses.
Yeah, it's, you know, we know that drug and alcohol abuse is problematic in our communities, and it's symptomatic of the trauma and abuse that I was telling you before. It's intergenerational, and it's often a coping mechanism and symptoms of deeper issues. So I don't want to stigmatize our communities.
Exactly.
And we only have some First Nations data, and it's only because that's some of the data we collect. So it's certainly not meant to stigmatize First Nations communities, but to say that it certainly is an issue, and it was an important program. Bloodborne diseases and sexually transmitted infections for HIV/AIDS program has been eliminated. 1.7 of all cases in Canada in 1992 rose to 7.2% in 2011. So we have you know, a huge issue for HIV/AIDS among Aboriginal people in Canada. And here in Regina, Aboriginal people accounted for 78.5%, actually in Saskatchewan, sorry, Aboriginal people accounted for 78.5% of new HIV cases in Saskatchewan in 2009.
And aren't the majority of those women?
A high majority are women, and a high majority are injection drug use.
Right.
In Regina, we're actually, I'm part of the ATRAC study, the Aboriginal Track study, that is funded by Public Health Agency of Canada, and we're partners with Regina Qu'Appelle Health Region, Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network, and All Nations Hope AIDS.
I was going to say, we should have had Margaret on the show with you.
Had Margaret on the show. She'd be able to spout more stats to you. But
we may do that in the next few weeks.
Yeah, and again, poverty, you know, poverty and residential trauma and intergenerational trauma and abuse, you know, highly linked to those issues. So it doesn't make sense to cut this program. The maternal and child health program has been cut. And again, we've got birth rates that are 1.5 times higher among Aboriginal women. We have infant mortality rates that are 4 times higher among Aboriginal people than non-Aboriginal people. And these are equal to developing countries such as Sri Lanka, Chile, and Fiji.
It's mind-boggling. Yeah, absolutely mind-boggling. When they say they respect First Nations, they respect Métis and Inuit people, and this does not sound like respectful treatment at all.
Yeah, the evidence just doesn't make sense to cut these programs. It's just, you know, the evidence is there to show that there's need for these programs.
But then again, they're expecting the provinces to take out the slack, aren't they?
Right. Yeah. I think they're trying to transfer these agendas to the province. Yeah.
Now, how does that work with the treaties?
I won't get to that, but the more important program they cut, I just want to say, is the Aboriginal Youth Suicide Prevention Strategy.
Oh,
and this
nice.
Is the one that bothered me the most. Because suicide rates for Aboriginal people across Canada is 2.1 times the national rate in general, but for women, it's 3 times the national rate. And for status First Nations youth, because we have that particular data, it's age 15 to 24, it is 8 times the national rate for females and 5 times the national rate for males. And they cut that program. I mean, suicides in some communities are epidemics.
Right.
We call them epidemics. Chiefs will call them epidemics in their communities. And they cut that suicide prevention program. And we have that evidence. We know that these are acute problems in our communities. So it's absolutely unbelievable that program has been cut. So, you know, trying to make sense of these cuts when we have the evidence is just mind-boggling. So you asked me a question, though.
Well, yeah, because to me this all relates back to treaties and responsibilities on both parts of a contract. There are responsibilities, no matter how old the contract is. How do how do we explain these cuts in funding for health care that are going to be and probably have already started so deeply affecting these communities?
Well, I mean, treaties are the United Nations sees treaties as nation-to-nation negotiations. And in Canada, we recognized First Nations as nations of people. And if these are nation-to-nation negotiations, then Canada is certainly not living up to their end of the bargain. And Treaty 6 was the Medicine Chest Treaty, and that treaty is the health treaty, right? And so, these cuts are completely defying the treaty right to health. First Nations people in particular, we have some Métis data and some Inuit data as well for sure, but we know First Nations people are the poorest of the poor, particularly on reserve, and certainly have the poorest health status bar none in Canada, and yet they're supposed to have treaty right to health. And Canada is not living up to its obligations. In fact, they're reneging on their obligations. If this is a treaty, if we're in a treaty relationship, then both ends need to live up to their obligations. And First Nations have lived up to their obligations.
How have they lived up to their obligations?
Well, First Nations agreed to share the lands and the resources, and boy, they've shared the lands and resources. Canada's a pretty wealthy nation, last time I checked. And First Nations sure have not benefited very well from these treaties. And if Canada doesn't want, to live up to the treaties, they don't want to live up to the bargain, I guess, we could renegotiate. And I don't think First Nations would once again negotiate for what they got, which is about 2% of Canada's land base.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was supposed to be a sharing of the land. This was supposed to be a sharing of the wealth. And that's not happening in Canada. And Canadians have and continue to benefit. And for First Nations people, they didn't even have the right to vote until 1960. They weren't even considered to be Canadian citizens. And yet, and yet they've honored treaty. And yet they fought in the Queen's Wars. And didn't have to under treaty. It's a crying shame that we're seeing the kinds of poverty and ill health in Canada, in our own backyard. And we need a United Nations, I don't even know how many committees have condemned Canada for their treatment of First Nations people. And we continue to turn a blind eye.
Well, I've heard about, you know, visitors to the north and to some of the communities up north from the United Nations, from other countries, who are absolutely shocked at what's happening,
yeah,
at the conditions that people are living in.
Yeah.
And they've been to third world countries or developing nations, as we call them now, and they don't see much difference.
No.
Or in one report I saw was that it's sometimes even worse.
Yeah.
In First Nation communities. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the average boil water advisory for a majority of First Nations was 728 days or something like that.
Wow.
728 days. A third of First Nations in Canada still don't have access to potable water. That's third world conditions.
That's a basic human right. Amnesty International is campaigning all the time for the right to clean water.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're talking basic human rights here.
Absolutely.
Healthcare, education, housing, maternal health, and what's going to happen.
Yeah, and there was no increase in this budget for more housing on reserve, and it's direly needed. We have multiple families living in, you know, 800 square foot houses, and then people wonder, you know, why are the houses on reserve in such disrepair? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you have people sleeping in shifts sometimes because there's not enough housing on reserve.
Yeah.
You know, if there's not enough housing in Toronto, I was talking to the MP on Tuesday about the housing shortage in Toronto. If there's not enough housing in Toronto, you know, well, that's very true, but there's not enough housing on reserves either. You know, there's not enough housing on reserves, and people are crammed into these houses that many of them were not built to code. I understand they're being built to code now, but many, for many years, were not
right.
built to code. Didn't have to be built to code on reserve.
No insulation.
Yeah, and so, but people are still living in those houses because that's what's there.
Right.
You know, that's what's there, that's what's available.
Do you foresee any talks or communication with the provincial government around this issue in the near future at all? Regarding these cuts and regarding what the province is willing to do?
Well, I think they're in a really tough position because, I mean, you know, First Nations want to hold the federal government accountable. If they don't hold them accountable, then the treaties become irrelevant. You know, so really, you know, the province is in a difficult position, too, of how much they can take on because those treaties are nation-to-nation agreements, right? And so
right.
the province really...
They really don't really have a say in any of this, do they?
They do need to provide, you know, proper service, and they have a role, but I mean, they can't take on everything that mm-hmm. that is being sent their way because these are federal arrangements,
right?
The federal government has a fiduciary responsibility for First Nations people. Now, the province has a role in off-reserve and for Métis people and for mm-hmm. Inuit people. That are living in their boundaries, but they have to be careful because First Nations people will hold accountable the federal government, and they have to hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. Those treaties are nation-to-nation agreements. So it becomes very complicated and very muddy in that regard. It doesn't let the province off the hook, for sure, but, you know, certainly there's much more to do in the urban centers and in the rural areas, maybe not on reserve, but certainly rural access, and where the health regions can work with First Nations, you know, so that when First Nations go off reserve for services or are in the hospital, that there can be better access and more culturally safe care and those kinds of things. But certainly there's a role to play, but they can't take on all of these things that the federal government is dropping because those are nation-to-nation, you know, things
right.
that have to happen.
Right. I have one last question, and it may not be the way you want to end it, so you can end it any way you want here. This is a very profound conversation. But, you know, I was thinking about the video that I've seen a few years ago about the Aboriginal healthcare program here, of which you're a part of. I've seen you on it. And I've shown it to young people that I've worked with and said, you know, this might be a fantastic opportunity for you if you want to go into healthcare to get training in many different fields. These funding cuts now, how are we looking at these programs, these training programs? Do you foresee any kind of problems with this?
Well, I heard it is starting to affect the medical program, and I feel it is going to trickle down into the research and scholarship. It's already affecting CIHR, Canadian Institute for Health Research funding, is facing massive cuts, and they're revamping their funding envelopes, and I believe that it is going to affect our ability to do community-based mm-hmm. research with First Nation and Métis and Inuit people. And I think it'll start to affect the ability, you know, for scholarships and that, you know, it's going to trickle down eventually. I mean, it's and now the you know, research is starting to shift around showing economic impact, for example.
Right.
Which, you know, I certainly can do. It's fairly easy to do that, but it's not something that I've ever really had to cognitively think about, that I've got to make an economic impact about the research I'm doing in communities. So it is definitely starting to change the landscape of the research, and having to rethink what we're doing. And I think it will start to affect the training programs, which is unfortunate, because I think the Aboriginal Health Human Resource program was cut.
Because we finally get to a point where we're starting to be able to educate young people and help them move forward and become successful, contributing young adults and support their families and be a part of their communities in a positive manner. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden the opportunities are fewer than they've had in the
past.
Well,
and post-secondary funding for First Nations students has not increased in 14 years.
Right.
And I think they're also looking at that as well. So I think we're going to see fewer First Nations students funded, fewer scholarship opportunities, and that means fewer people in the field, and that's not what we want.
Right.
You know, we need more.
And a huge impact on Aboriginal, Métis, and Inuit healthcare.
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Carey Brass.
Thank you so much for having me. Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And take it away, Jim.
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For info on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Every Tuesday at 7 p.m., Amnesty letter writing is at Atlantis Coffee at Victoria Avenue and Hamilton Street. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."